It's Diane. On my mind, rethinking our understanding of the gentler sex. Since the days of Charles Darwin, females of the animal kingdom have been thought of as passive, coy, submissive, and chaste. In a new book, zoologist Lucy Cook argues that vision is based more in stereotype than in fact. Through examples of promiscuous songbirds, murderous meerkats, and fish that transition from diminutive male to dominant female, she bursts open myths that have shaped our understanding of evolutionary biology for centuries. Lucy Cook's new book is Bitch, on the female of the species. I talked with her earlier this summer about how scientists got sexual difference wrong and the research that helped set the record straight. Lucy, it's wonderful to have you with us. I must say, you've chosen a rather shocking title for your book. Did you choose it?
So my apologies to anybody who is offended by the title, but in my view, the word, if I'm able to say it, bitch.
Of course.
It's a female word for a dog. You know, it shouldn't be a swear word, right? And what my book is about how female behavior encompasses all sorts of behaviors that might encourage people to use swear words, but in most cases, the females in question are just being assiduously maternal. So I'm trying to reclaim the word, really.
Good. I'm glad. So let's start with your own introduction to zoology. What did you learn about males and females and their differences as well as their similarities?
Right. So I studied zoology at Oxford in the late 1980s, and I was tutored by Richard Dawkins, in fact, who some of your listeners may well be familiar with. And I specialised in evolutionary biology, and I was taught that males and females had rigid sex differences and in terms of their behaviour. And males were essentially active and females were essentially passive. Males were the dominant drivers of evolution. They were led swashbuckling lives of thrusting agency, and they had sex with lots of females because they needed to spread their seed far and wide, and they were dominant, whereas females were basically passive, coy, and monogamous. We were kind of bit part players in the evolutionary story.
You were taught that, and all that goes back to Darwin, to what was considered absolute truth.
Yes. I mean, this was, you know, Darwin's my hero. You know, his theory of evolution by natural selection is one of the greatest scientific theories ever. But, you know, he was also a man of his time. What's fascinating to me is even a scientist who's brilliant and meticulous as Darwin can't escape cultural bias. And you know, the cultural norms of the time were decidedly misogynistic. Females were second-class citizens. So when he came to brand the female of the species, she came out in the shape of a Victorian housewife, passive, coy, monogamous, because that was what was seemly at the time. And then the problem is because Darwin said that, and he was a genius, the scientists that followed in his wake for decades have suffered from a chronic case of confirmation bias. So that's why I'm still being taught that over 100 years later.
So when and why did you begin to question what he had written?
Well, I'd always sat uncomfortably, I'll be honest. And it was, I tell you, my first inkling of the fact that the paradigm that I'd been taught at university wasn't true was about 15 years ago. And I was in the Serengeti and I was doing a BBC documentary about animal communication, and we were doing an experiment with playback trying to talk to a male lion. We had like a lion's roar and we were hoping to sort of get another male lion to roar at us. And I ended up roaring so loudly that I stole a lion's girlfriend because we attracted not just two males and a female lion. And the two males just disappeared when they didn't find anything that looked or smelled like a male lion. But the female lion stayed and pinned me to the spot for over 2 hours. And I asked the lion expert that I was with what was going on. He said, she wants to mate with us. And I was like, well, isn't she mating with one of those other males? He's like, yeah, but female lions are incredibly promiscuous. They'll mate over 100 times when they're in their fertile period with multiple males. And I was like, whoa, that's not what I was taught. Why does that happen? So then I sort of started digging around and I discovered that this idea that females are wired for chastity and males are wired for promiscuity, it just isn't true. it's thanks to some trailblazing female scientists, mostly, but not exclusively, who have changed our understanding in female behavior.
So give me an example of how Darwin's bias has played out over the years.
Well, I think the idea of that females are coy and wired for chastity is an incredibly pervasive one. It was something that I was basically taught as universal law at university. So I think that's one of the most pervasive. And so we now understand, you know, through the work of people like Sarah Blaffer-Hurdy and Patricia Goarty, these amazing scientists who kind of benefited from an egalitarian education and were able to go into the field and study animals and pay attention to females. Even if they were behaving in ways outside of the paradigm, they were able to go, well, hang on a second, why is that lioness having sex with lots of different males? Why would that be? Rather than ignoring it, right? So, you know, we now know, for example, that females mate multiply in species as diverse as lions, lobsters and lizards. And really, there's a number of reasons. You know, firstly, don't put all your eggs in one basket. By mating with multiple males, you increase the chance of hitting the genetic jackpot and getting a great genetic fit. And secondly, it's often a strategy that females will use. And this is the case with the lioness, to manipulate males, essentially, because, you know, by mating, the male lions are infanticidal, as are many species of primate and mammal. And the reason why Sarah Blaffer-Hurdy figured out the reason why they are infanticidal is by killing a female's babies, it forces her into her fertile period. So she's receptive to have this new male's babies immediately. But her strategy to prevent that is by mating multiply with all the males in the area. And in that way, it confuses paternity. So, you know, this is a really clever strategy and it just shows that, yeah, females are just as sexually strategic as males, and their strategy often involves mating with multiple males.
But Lucy, I had for a lifetime been under the impression that it only took one seed, one sperm, in order to fertilize. So if a lioness mates with a number of males, who knows who the paternal lion is? And does she care?
She does care, actually. Female choice, and to credit Darwin, he did propose the idea of female choice, but So his idea that underpinned his idea of sexual selection was that males compete and then females choose. You know, that was the Victorian pinhole version of, you know, we now know that females compete and males choose and all sorts of other forces exist. But he did say that females choose. But what he didn't realise is that, you know, he thought female choice was a relatively passive affair. And it also ended at choosing a mate. But now we know that actually that sperm competition happens inside females. So females may choose in numbers of species to mate with multiple males so that within her, she's able to choose the best genetic fit. And actually the most amazing thing, I mean, I had no idea. So you're taught that there's this sort of sperm race that goes on, you know, when a male mates with a female, and the winning sperm, you know, is the one that gets to fertilize the egg. Well, there was a study done on human females only a couple of years ago that found that in the end, it's the egg that chooses, right? So this female choice goes right down to the wire. And it doesn't matter if you're the first sperm that arrives. If you're a bit wonky or genetically incompatible, it might be that the female egg doesn't choose you in the end. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, there's so many myths around this that all place males in this active role and females in this passive role. But we're now discovering females are just as active as males.
Now, what about penguins? We've told that they mate for life. So what's the truth?
Well, I hate to break it to you, Diane, but monogamy, but birds do social monogamy really well, and that they look like they're devoted a couple, but sexual monogamy less so. So penguins are the same as many other species, where females will mate multiply because, you know, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. And by mating with multiple males, they increase the chance of a good genetic compatibility. In fact, only less than 7% of all bird species are actually monogamous. And it was Patricia Goarty who discovered this. And she was studying bluebirds, actually. Eastern bluebirds, which are obviously the star of Zippity Doo Dah and about as all American as apple pie. And she did DNA fingerprinting on their eggs back in on a clutch of eggs in a nest back in the 1980s, and found that they had multiple fathers. And so, you know, she's effectively calling this star of Disney a Jezebel. It was never going to go down well. But you know, there was a huge amount of resistance to her data. And you know, she was told, oh, the only way that this could be possible is that the females are being raped. There's no way that the females will be actively seeking sex with other males. And of course, you know, it took other clever scientists being ingenious and fitting radio trackers on the back of female birds to trace them, to see that, yeah, they were flying into other territories and soliciting sex with other males. And they were completely active in that process.
So her work was initially dismissed, and it took years of what, male and female research to get to it and to verify what she had done?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Patty is a feminist firebrand. You know, she's really taken a lot of these stereotypes to task and really sort of, you know, sought to sort of replicate fundamental experiments that underpin these ideas and all sorts of incredible. She's an exemplary scientist, but yet her science gets questioned for being ideological, number one, which I think is completely ludicrous because, you know, Darwin's science was based in misogyny, you know, so like, you know, at least she wears her ideology out there. Do you know what I mean? I don't think you can discredit her science, which is sound, on the grounds of being ideological. And yeah, it took a massive fight for her and many others to have their data accepted. And I do want to stress that it's not just women who are fighting this fight. There are lots of male scientists in my book who have done amazing work as well, yeah, studying female animals. So, I mean, you know, science is based around questions, and I think it took women to sort of question, you know, these female stereotypes, because the questions come from the heart, right? You're like, well, that doesn't seem to make sense to me. Whereas if you're a man, you're more naturally interested in the male story. But there are still plenty of male scientists who've also fought this fight alongside people like Patty and Sarah.
Well, was there a reason behind creating this myth of monogamy among females? Was there a sense that a monogamous woman would be a better mother?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, we seem to be very, very caught up with this idea, you know, you know, I'm no expert in human culture. I just study animals, you know, but it does seem that it's, you know, this idea that, you know, there is this idea that you know, monogamy and motherhood go in hand in hand. But actually, if you look at the animal kingdom, you know, one of the signs of being a good mother, in if you're a lion, will be being promiscuous. So, you know, it's not true.
You also write about sexual pleasure among female animals. What did you learn, and tell me why that's so important?
Well, yeah, so this is one of the things that, you know, was amazing to me. And, you know, but I had no idea that all female mammals have a clitoris, right? It's like all mammals do.
I had no idea that either.
I know. So there's a load of male scientists, in it, particularly in the sort of 1970s and 1980s, who said that, oh, human females are the only species to have an orgasm. And the only reason that they'd feel any pleasure is because of this homologous development with the penis. So, you know, the fetus starts out as sexually neutral. And so we have a sort of shared blueprint for our equipment, right? And so basically we have males to thank for our own sexual pleasure. We didn't even evolve our own orgasms, you know. So there was loads of male scientists saying, you know, female animals don't have orgasms, and loads of female scientists screaming, yes, they do, you know. And there was like, so there's been a number of experiments now that have shown that macaques certainly, you know, they, you know, Masters and Johnson had that sort of set of how you can, you know, there's like various different criteria, contractions, et cetera, et cetera. And macaques certainly do experience orgasm. And Patricia Brennan, who's this amazing scientist out of Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts, she recently did a full histology on the dolphin clitoris and found all the nerve endings and everything that you'd expect. It looks like exactly like we have. And there's every reason to believe that female dolphins experience pleasure. And of course, you know, evolution is, you know, they're going to be rewarded for, if having sex with multiple males is a good thing, because it protects your offspring, you're going to get rewarded for that, right? So, you know, the different morphology, I mean, clitoral morphology across the animal kingdom is hugely varied. It's not just a question of being a homology of the penis. It's, you know, it screams adaptation, such variety. So, yeah, that's a myth that I was very happy to bring down. So it's good to see your animal sisters enjoying themselves. They're having to have that much sex.
And wasn't it the macaque who or which was having fun masturbating and enjoying herself a great deal?
Yeah, even Jane Goodall writes about this, actually. She writes about how, I mean, so numerous primates have been observed masturbating, females have been, and bonobos have even been seen fashioning their own sort of French tickler out of twigs. Can you believe it? Jane Goodall writes about seeing a female chimpanzee pleasuring herself, and that she was laughing quietly to herself as she did it, which I think is just such a lovely description. So you know, the sort of description in French is always, the orgasm is le petit mort, but you know, in the case of this chimpanzee, it was le petit rire. It was a little laugh.
But, you know, with that description, one can imagine why male scientists might be threatened to write about such things.
Yeah, I think it's just that there's a taboo around talking about these things in females, isn't there? I mean, you know, even the terminology is feels a bit taboo, doesn't it? Like, you can't, you know, people sort of readily talk about penises in science. It's, you know, the penis is everywhere. Science is obsessed with penises, but vaginas, less so. And using those words, vagina, clitoris, it feels naughty. Like, you shouldn't, you know, I and I've been writing about this stuff for ages, when I'm on radio, I think, oh, can I say that? You know, of course I can say that. Yeah, of course I should be able to. So I think there's all sorts of reasons culturally why we find this difficult.
Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture,
and
curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Lucy Cook. Her new book is Bitch, on the Females and the Species. So if enjoying sex is not only for reproduction, what else is it for?
Well, that's a great question. So we have this idea that sex is just for reproduction, and it's a very kind of Victorian idea. But actually, we see in the animal kingdom, sex has loads of functions. And you see lots of animals having sex for pleasure. Orcas are one. They have a lot. And bonobos particularly have a lot of sex. And basically, the role of sex is to foster relationships. You know, it enables individuals to bond with one another. And those individuals don't need to be of opposite sex. They can be of the same sex. I mean, we see a huge amount of same-sex sexual activity in the animal kingdom, you know, which was the sort of second kind of bias that I discovered in when writing this book, along with the sort of sexist bias that was sort of, you know, started off by Darwin, but then this heteronormative bias that we sort of assume that individuals that are copulating are always going to be male and female. And often, I mean, in the case of bonobos, female bonobos will preferentially, you know, bonobos famous, they're the make love, not war hippie ape, right? They have a lot of sex, and it's kind of like a handshake, and it means their society is incredibly peaceful. We're equally related to chimps and bonobos. They're both great apes. We share the same amount of DNA. And whereas chimpanzees are sort of aggressive and warlike, bonobos have this very peaceful society.
Yes.
Because they're all having sex with each other, you know.
Is it because there are no males around, or is it because they prefer having sex with the same sex?
Well, you know, without being able to actually ask a female who she prefers having sex with, it would be suggested that they actually prefer having sex with other females because Amy Parrish, who studies them, she's based out of San Diego, she found that the females, you know, when a male will present themselves to a female or a female will at the same time, the female will choose to copulate with the female. And actually the female's clitoris has migrated to a position where it gains most pleasure from this, it's called GG rubbing, the type of sex that they have. There's an evolutionary reason for this sexual pleasure that they derive with other females, is that it strengthens the bonds amongst these females, and they have this incredibly powerful sisterhood. And so the bonobo, as opposed to the chimpanzee, which is male dominated, the bonobos are female dominant because the power of this sisterhood, they don't allow males to aggressively dominate them. So this sex has a very sensible function, and they definitely enjoy it. I mean, Amy's convinced that they orgasm. She says, you know, they shriek and scream and look like they're having a whale of a time, you know.
So do the males have as much sexual activity with other males as the females do with other females?
Well, you'll have to ask me that question in a couple of years' time, because that's what my next book's going to be about, is about how science got males wrong, and I'll be able to answer that. But I know that you do get a lot of same sexual activity between males, yeah, for sure, and it'll serve the same function. You know, I mean, it's very useful in establishing and maintaining bonds. Plus, it's fun, feels good. You know, so if you've got it, use it. You know.
Now, what about the so-called maternal instinct? Is it really there?
Well, I was really interested in this one because I'm somebody who's never been very maternal, and I chose not to have children. It just wasn't something that I wanted to do, and I always felt like a bit of a freak for it. Just, what's wrong with me? I don't see. I mean, people would hand me, when they have a baby, and I'd be like, oh, I don't want to touch that. It looks sort of wobbly. Head might fall off. I'm not interested. So I was really interested to find that. But basically, this idea, and I think it's really damaging, this idea that all females are meant to have this maternal instinct. Because if you don't have it, then you feel really lacking, you know? But actually, in the animal kingdom, you know, I think there isn't really a maternal instinct as such. Motherhood's difficult. It doesn't matter whether you're a human or a baboon. There's a lot to learn, right? And you'll see with baboons, a long-term study that Jean Altman did, the female baboons, the first-time mums, their firstborn are 60% more likely to die than subsequent offspring, you know, because it's a steep learning curve. They've got to learn how to nurse, be on the move, you know, all the other. It's really difficult, right? So I thought that was a really heartening thing for, you know, I've got plenty of my friends who, you know, girlfriends who've really struggled with their firstborn. And, you know, hey, that's normal, right? And secondly, it seems a switch for nurturing instinct that exists in the brains of, it's been found, Lauren O'Connell at Stanford found it in frogs, and the same switch, the same neurons were involved in it in mice was found by Catherine Dulac at Harvard. And so it's basically like, it's like a switch for parenting, but it has to be triggered. So it's an instinct, but it has to be triggered. But it's interestingly, it's the same in males and females.
That's what I was going to ask. If the male with whom the female has mated sees that the female has no such instinct, is the male likely, perhaps, to step in?
Well, I think these roles have sort of, It's less about the male deciding, because that's putting too much sort of kind of cognitive thought probably into it. And really these roles are defined by the environment and the peculiar environments that different species have evolved in. So for example, you know, amongst primates, you have, you know, some species where females are the sole carers, some where there's co-parenting, and some where males do a lot of the care, and the females, you know, save their energy for lactation and other things, and the males do a lot of the heavy lifting. So, and then when you look in, you know, in other species like frogs, it might be males or females, but generally it's not something that an individual will decide. It's more about it's a combination. It's sort of the environment that the animals, the species find itself, that will dictate the behavior. But, you know, what that says is that it doesn't, there's not a pattern, you know, like as Darwin or whatever would say that females always do this role. It's not the case. They don't always do the role. You know, it's about sort of environmentally dependent on the situation.
Now, the other thing here is that, as you said earlier, male scientists have indeed contributed to this knowledge, but it strikes me that if it hadn't been for some women to step forward and be part of the mix, that you wouldn't have had this kind of other view of what's going on.
I mean, 100%, Diane. I mean, you know, it's absolutely, there's, you know, the likes of Sarah Blaffer Hurdy, Patricia Goarty, Mary Jane West Eberhard, and Jean Altman, you know, we have those women to thank for fighting the scientific phylocracy with fierce data and logic and winning, you know. And I think the reason why is, as I said, you know, science is based in questions. You ask questions that you want to find the answers to, and you know, if you're a woman and you're looking at a situation, you're going to be interested in the females in that situation. You know, and you're going to be curious about what evolution is like from the perspective of a mother or a sister or a daughter. So I think that's why it was women who paved the way, who were the pioneering scientists in all of this. because, you know, it's all too easy for men to get distracted by showy male, you know, histrionics. But it took females to ask different questions.
But, you know, it's also interesting. You spoke about the bonobos. I've got a special feeling in my heart for the bonobos, but there are so many species where the females have not got the peaceful outlook that the bonobos have.
I mean, you know, there are lots of societies which are really brutal, and they're not only the ones that are led by males, frankly. I mean, meerkat society is tense and homicidal. In fact, every meerkat has a 1 in 5 chance of being killed by another meerkat, most probably its own mother or sister. And it's the females that are in charge, and they're really aggressive and really brutal. They're a type of mongoose that live in Africa, and they're like the star of TV shows, you know, cute little meerkats, and they're all cute and clumsy and, you know, a bit like Charlie Chaplin. But their society owes more to Joseph Stalin than to Charlie Chaplin, and it's a female that's in charge. So I think that's really interesting, actually, is that these highly competitive societies, whether it's a female that's in charge or a male, they're pretty brutal. So again, it's a gender neutral thing. It's not just necessarily toxic masculinity. It could be toxic femininity as well.
So I realize that you are studying animal creatures. Does your mind drift toward human beings and how similar we are with the animal kingdom?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to draw comparisons,
yeah,
and to
exactly.
see, you know, to see a reflection. I mean, I'll tell you one where I really struggled not to see my reflection was with the orcas, because the orcas are killer whales, and they, you know, they're basically like souped up dolphins, basically. They're really social, live in these social family pods, and it was thought for a long time that the males were in charge. Of course, that's what everybody thought, because they were bigger. But it turns out it's not just the females that are in charge. It's the postmenopausal grannies that are leading the community. They're basically the sort of wise old lady whales that they stop reproducing halfway through their life in order to care for their existing offspring and their offspring. And they're the repositories for ecological wisdom that keep their clan alive. And so they're out the front leading the group. And so I had to go and research this, because menopause is really rare in the animal kingdom. In fact, it's only humans and 4 species of toothed whale that go through the menopause. So I was like, oh, God, I wonder whether they get cranky moods and hot flushes. You know, I need to find out. But I didn't get an answer to that. But what I did discover is that if you're an orca and you go through menopause, rather than sort of shrinking back from society and feeling like you're useless, you know, you actually go out to the front and you're leading society, and your knowledge is what's keeping your entire clan safe. And I found that very pleasing. And also, I'll just give you one other tidbit, which is also I couldn't help but be titillated by. But it turns out that these older orca matriarchs are extremely sexually active. And the young males, when they want to sort of start practicing wielding their penises, they do so with the older matriarchs. That's who they go to learn from. So orcas are the new cougars.
So we come to the question of sexual binary animals transitioning from male to female or female to male. Do you see any of that?
There are a lot of animals that change sex in the animal kingdom. They are,
how do they do that?
Well, it's, you know, that's being studied. But, you know, one of them is the anemone fish, which is the Finding Nemo fish. And, you get a pair of anemones, anemone fish, that a male and female that live in an anemone with a couple of immature males. Females are dominant. They're much bigger. And so if you remove the female, then the male turns into a female, and the the young males that are in the clan, one of them will develop, become sexually mature and start mating with effectively his father.
What you're saying is that their organs change, their bodily features change. How does that happen?
Well, you know, that's such a great question. And, you know, there's a chap called Justin Rhodes in University of Ohio who's been studying that. And you want to know the most fascinating thing about this change, which is just mind-blowing, really, is that as soon as you take the dominant female out and the male who's left behind is almost immediately recognized as a female fish and starts behaving as a female, right? But apparently it takes the gonads up to a year to change from being testes that make sperm to being ovaries that make eggs. So what's fascinating to me about that is you see that this, you know, the fact that the fish, you know, behaves as a female, is recognized as a female, but its gonads are male, would suggest that sex behavior and sexuality and sexual identity are independently regulated to biological sex, the sex of the gonads, you know. So I think that's even in a fish. So I think that's really fascinating.
It's all fascinating, every single bit of it. And I want to hear why you think all this is so important for us to know and understand more thoroughly.
Well, I just think, you know, these stereotypes of female passivity and male dominance, and they just get trotted out all the time and you know, used against women to say that, you know, we should only be certain ways because, you know, that's what Darwin said, and, you know, males are wired to be dominant and females are wired to be submissive. And you know, it's just not true, you know. And so I just think it's really important that we understand that the variety of the female experience, and that it doesn't conform to these archaic stereotypes, and we don't need to be pigeonholed by that.
So do you believe that the research you and other scientists are doing is going to ultimately have an impact on how we as humans see ourselves, male, female, or trans?
Absolutely, I think it will. I think you know, the key to all of this is diversity in science, you know, and women are now reaching senior positions in science, and, you know, we're getting a diversity of genders and sexualities and cultures, you know, asking questions from different perspectives. Yes. And that's going to make us understand the animal kingdom so much better, and then therefore understand ourselves better as well.
Well, Lucy Cook, what a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, the pleasure was all mine, Diane. It was just fantastic. Thank you so much. Brilliant questions. I loved it.
That was zoologist Lucy Cook. Her new book is Bitch, on the Females of the Species. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. Talk to you next time. I'm Diane Rehm.